Good evening. Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening, Maka. Do you have any questions for tonight?
I have one. Is the Zohar, is that the oral writings, all of the oral writings?
No.
No.
The Zohar is one aspect of the oral writings. The Talmud, which consists of the Mishnah and the Gemara, all three are the essential oral writings that was given to Moses at Mount Sinai along with the written Torah. In addition, there is oral writings called Midrash that fills in the gaps in the written Torah from a story level, from a historical level, and from many other ways. Because the Midrash also includes morals and ethics in the form of stories. And then there is other writings by the sages over the centuries that is considered oral Torah as well. I believe somebody else arrived, so good evening. The question that was asked, good evening, Hannah. The question that was asked was, is the Zohar the complete oral Torah? And I was explaining that there's the Zohar, the Talmud, which consists of the Gemara and the Mishnah, generally considered the oral Torah that was given to Moses at Mount Sinai. In addition, there is Midrash and other writings over the centuries that help to explain all of these different oral laws. And then in around the 1300s to 1600s, the halakha, which is the pathway, was codified and written down and solidified because it was written down. Whenever you write something down, you create a structure that so it becomes less able to change. So, Mark, I'm not Judah sure.
Was it Judah the Prince that did the writing down?
Well, prior to Judah the Prince, who was the head of the nation after the destruction of the temple,
mm-hmm.
after Judah the Prince became the head of the nation through people recognizing he has the authority, they gave him the authority. He felt he received permission because prior to that, the oral Torah was never written down. The most that was written were notes by students that heard lectures from their teachers, from their masters. Mm-hmm. So their notes were down, and those notes have come down to us in the form of what's called the Baraita. And it's literally the notes that a student had when he was receiving the information from his master, from his teacher. His teachers were the members of the Sanhedrin. And the students that became the head of the Sanhedrin became the members of the Sanhedrin. They essentially were taught by the various existing members of the Sanhedrin. Judah the Prince said, with the exile, people are losing this information, so we need to codify it. So he authorized the writing down of the Jerusalem Talmud, which consists of the Mishnahs and the Gemaras that were written down over a 400 or 500 year period. But the main center of the Jewish world was in Babylonia after the first temple was destroyed and the exile went into Babylonia. When the second temple was authorized to be rebuilt, not the whole nation did not come out of Babylonia. Many stayed. And the Talmud Chacham, the teachers of the generation, remained in Babylonia, and they record what is known as the Babylonian Talmud. The typical answer that the Kabbalah gives, the Talmud, both the external Talmud, meaning the Babylonian Talmud, and the internal Talmud, meaning the Jerusalem Talmud that was written in the land of Israel, they represent the how, but not the why of the laws, of the mitzvot, of the history. The Zohar is explained as being the soul of the Torah. It is explaining the why of the various mitzvot, the various halachot, the various stories. So when it comes to something written in the Talmud that is in conflict with something written in the Zohar, the traditional expectation is that the Zohar will be the correct answer, the correct statement. But we always have to remember that what was written in the Talmud is also correct. It is part of the understanding that everything is relative and there's 70 explanations for everything. But that goes against human nature. That goes against human desire. Tell me what to do. Make my life clear and explicit. Don't give me relativity. I don't really want relativity. Because with relativity comes responsibility. Malka, did you get a clear understanding answer to your question?
Yes, sir. One more question: is all of these sources in, is all these sources in English as well?
Not completely in English, but many are. So the Babylonian Talmud has been translated into English in two ways. There's two sources. One is called the Koran Talmud, and the other is from Art Scroll. Art Scroll can be found also through an online app they have provided so that you can buy the 36 volumes, I think it is, of the Jerusalem Talmud. And Art Scroll is in the process of translating what's been translated is the Babylonian Talmud, but Art Scroll is in the process of translating the Jerusalem Talmud and putting it, but they have not yet put it into their apps. I don't believe they've made that available. But it is available in print. But not all of the writings that I've mentioned have been translated into English. The Tikkuni Zohar that we are studying is the first complete translation of the Tikkuni Zohar. The Sulam commentary that we are using is the first English translation But the Hebrew translation of the Aramaic Zohar was only done completed in the 50s by Rabbi Ashlag. He translated it from the Aramaic to the Hebrew along with his commentary. And then the Kabbalah Center around the year 2000 translated it into English. So not everything is in English, but much of the writings are beginning to be translated into English. But the translators are academics. Some are Orthodox rabbis. Some translators are take to heart and into their life the practice that they translate. But not all. And so you need to be aware of the agendas involved. Many of the translators are not are Christian scholars. And there is the same aspect from the Quran as well. Again, I will ask, is it clear or is, because we can continue if you want to ask more questions.
Well, how do we know if we order these translations, how do we know it's the original translation?
How do you know that it's an original translation?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of writings out there, so you mentioned Ortro. I understand that. Yeah.
And the Koren, Koren, is a publisher of the same Talmud with a different translator.
Okay.
How do you know the source? Who the translator is, you have to do the research.
Okay.
You have to delve into it. If you read the handouts of the Tikkuni Zohar, right at the beginning of each one of the web pages, I basically explain that this is the first English translation. That the translator's commentary is mixed in to the translation, and it's difficult to identify what is a commentary by the translator and what is a direct translation. And so you have to be careful. But it's also all that we have. There was an earlier partial English translation printed about, I think, in the 20s by the Sonsino family publishers in Italy. But they left out great sections of the Zohar because their translators were not practicing and they really couldn't understand it, so they didn't translate it.
The very first book I read was called Every Man's Talmud. At the time, that was way back in the 80s, and there were only 5 books in our city library that were Jewish books. But that little book, I thought it was excellent. And from time to time, I still go back to it. I felt like it gave an overview of, I guess you'd say, Talmud. And then from time to time in Torah studies, we've taken a passage from the Talmud. And, you know, you see the Hebrew on one side, and then you see English on the other side. Some is commentary, and there may be a paragraph that will say that it came, if it was written in the year 600, or, you know, I'll give you an example say someone who fell over a fence and who was responsible, and just through generations of generations that added commentary to that particular thing that was being discussed. So it's, you know, you almost have to look at each volume of your Talmud. I know I had started making a collection. I think I had two books before we went to Israel, and I didn't take them with me. I gave them to someone because I was starting to make the collection. But
if you go and read get a volume of the Talmud, and I'll tell you, the Art Scroll Talmud, if you look at the Hebrew side of the page, one side is Hebrew, one side is English. But it's called a daf, meaning a section. And what there is in the printing is the middle is the Mishnah. The Mishnah was the first teachings by all of these Sanhedrin expert, you know, ex-teachers. The Mishnah is very cryptic. And so the sages from the year 300 to 600 roughly would make commentary and explain the Mishnah. But the way it's printed, in the center of the page is the Mishnah, and around that is the commentaries from various groups over various centuries. So one of the groups is called the Tosafists. And they lived in France in the 1100s, 1100. And so their commentary was, they were commenting both on the Mishnah directly, but also on the earlier Gemara that came out of Babylonia. And so that's one commentary. Then there's a commentary by Rashi. And all around the middle of the page is the Mishnah, and around the outside are different commentaries on the Mishnah and on earlier Gemaras associated to help people understand it. And it's literally people speaking across time. There was a comment, let's say the Mishnah was written in 300. Well, in 500, someone read the Mishnah and commented, explained that Mishnah. Then in 700, somebody else was commenting on what the guy at 500 said. And then in the 1000, the Tosafists commented on both of them. And so you have this back and forth discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredibly enlightening. It also teaches people how to think. And this has been the study of Jewish education since the fall of the temple, and probably before as well. I do recommend you go and find a copy of it so you can see what it's describing. And that's really what Hannah was just describing. Every man's Talmud was explaining that and bringing different sections, but it wasn't bringing all of it. He would bring a certain daf, a certain page, and go through all of the different commentaries and all of the different history of the people so that you could understand why people were saying certain things. I'll give you an example. One of the things that the Mishnah says is that maggots in meat are spontaneously generated by the meat. Because in that time, they didn't have the ability to see the microscopic fly eggs that hatched into maggots. So they thought they just spontaneously appeared. But then later on in the 600s, 700s, 800s, they had some microscopes. They had some ability to see the small fly eggs, and they realized that it was a natural evolution. The fly laid its eggs, and they hatched into maggots. And the maggot would eat the meat that was decaying until it grew big enough to become a fly and fly away. That's just an example from a standpoint of scientific. There's arguments that have been going on for 2,000 years. Do we accept the spiritual status of the earlier writers, or do we say that we are more knowledgeable because we have more science and more clear science? And the tradition is that the earlier people were more spiritual, and so we accept their writings, except when, and this is the current debate between the rationalists who say, you can't accept the writing that says the maggots are spontaneous birth, because we know better scientifically, so you have to learn to modify that they are spiritually higher from the earlier generations, but there has to be common sense and rationale in what we learn and how we understand what God told Moses. Because what's part of Torah is science. It's one of the 70 aspects of the Torah. So as science develops and proves itself, we have to integrate that into the Torah, and that's what current sages are doing. Are there any other questions?
I know this doesn't in a way relate, but we've been having flies for the last week. And I'm amazed at our classes and the discussions and the examples that you give, that you have no idea what's going on. But we have a new neighbor. Well, he's been there several months, but he's a young man, and he's a fisherman, and he gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning and goes fishing, and he's not married, and so he's kind of letting his yard go, and he forgets to put out his trash can. And this week, Tony put out his trash can for him, okay? Then this past week, he didn't put the trash can out again. So Tony went to look, and the trash, and I told him, I said, somewhere around here there's maggots. You know, so check the yard. Maybe there's a dead animal or something, you know. Well, it was that garbage can was full of maggots. And he said he would have gone and he would have washed it for him, but if he would have done that, then the maggots would have gone all over the yard, and then it would have smelled in his yard and our yard. So anyway, he had the opportunity to tell the young man that he needed to hose his garbage can. What we're seeing is these young these young people just don't know how to do things. They don't know how to cut grass. They don't know, you know, just simple things. And or that they have to clean their garbage can every week. You have to hose it out in hot weather. So anyway, he had the opportunity to tell him that he didn't empty the garbage for him, put it out for the garbage truck, and that he would have rinsed it. It needed rinsing, but he didn't want to rinse it because it had maggots, and if he would have done it, we'd be smelling our yards. But then the two of them, he said, but you know what? There's a drain right here. Maybe you can take, that's where you can drain it. So we solved our fly problem. And I couldn't help but smile when you gave the example of the maggots because and the flies. Because, you know, you said don't kill.
How can you know, say I didn't know that was going on?
Okay, so anyway, our everyday life is so, and it's so intertwined with everything that we study. It's just, you know, it's awesome.
It is truly amazing, and I understand and agree with you.
And I could keep quiet and not tell you that, but I think I should tell you just so you know. That, well, I know you know, but anyway.
I think you may have forgotten the teaching that I always bring up when somebody brings up flies. Why did God create flies? Martha,
well,
you haven't heard this. You have to answer it.
I always said that God created, because he has to clean the earth, because as Hannah just said, a lot of people just don't know that it needs to be cleaned, you know.
Right.
So I think that he has certain animals that he created in creation. I mean, there's just different hierarchies in the animal world as well. And just like in the oceans, you have dwellers in the ocean that cleans the bottom of the ocean floors, you know, that
right.
eat bacteria and stuff like that. So I always said that they're the janitors of the world, some of these animals. Because humans...
And you're absolutely correct. But that's the maggots. How come he created flies? He could have just created maggots and have them die off. Why did he create that they grow into a fly?
Mercy.
So that we could learn to use finding by striking and not kill them when they're around and talk to them and tell them, you leave me alone, I'll leave you alone.
Exactly.
Well, you know,
he created a fly to teach you patience.
What?
To teach us patience. He created the fly to teach us patience. So that when he bothers you and you want to shoo him away, you get to stop that reaction and the fly goes away anyway.
True. Well, we have the same.
I speak to the fly. I speak to them and I say, you don't come in this house. I'm your boss. So, you know, because I don't want to fool with you, and you know. But this week it was it was like every time we opened the door, there was a fly. There were like two and three, so there had to be something.
Right.
There had to be the source of it. But anyway, your example for me.
Where I live in a very wooded area, and we have deer flies and we have horse flies, which are quite large sometimes.
Right.
And they hurt. They hurt really bad when they bite. And so we've been dealing with that situation for the last several weeks, is the deer flies and the horse flies. And they may be
right.
the same, but they're a little pesky. And we do open the door, and they come in. And if, I don't know what happens to him some of the time. Some of the times we just find him on the floor, you know. But, yeah, we're dealing with more of the larger size flies. And I, because I live in the wooded area, and it's hot. It's been very hot, so. But I shoo them away. Sometimes they listen, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they want to bite me before they leave. Yeah. And I do get bitten quite often.
Well, when you're doing all this cooking that I'm doing for my friends that are coming, I can't afford to have a fly in the house. And I was having two and three. And I was already watching my food and, you know, to make sure it was covered and really cool, because you can't put it up in the freezer or anything until it's perfectly cool. Oh, so anyway, your flies were, was a good example to that. And I just,
well, you guys have flies, but I have bees, and one of them just stung me a while ago.
Oh.
So what did you
learn? It probably went after your perfume. It probably went after your perfume if you had perfume on.
No, I don't wear perfume. And the bee was in my chair, and I sat on him. So y'all can laugh.
Well, I was getting
that's not your
sweeping personality.
That's not what
you said
on it. I don't know.
But Brandy, that's not a sting.
And miraculously, when I got up, the bee was still alive.
As I said, it's not a sting. It's a love tap.
Well, I'm telling you, he tapped me, brother. Oh, Lord.
Okay, sister.
That's it.
I hope you find somebody who will help you put some cream on it.
No, ain't nobody around. I have to just manage to do it myself.
Does anybody have any questions?
Well, I wanted to ask about the coupling on the class that we had Monday of the souls of the converts, but I didn't have a chance to go back and look at the handout. But I think my question was basically is that I can do it quickly, and you can tell me if you want to wait till next week. When it made the idea that after midnight that the souls of the converts couple, I think that's the way I understood it. And it made me wonder, I mean, I'm not so sure I know what coupling means, but if they create souls, then I would think that what we would think of would be Zvug. And I wondered if those souls were soulmates when they were on the earth.
What we read, you're talking about the advanced reincarnation class, right? Or what the Ari was writing about?
I think it was the Ari's writing, and I don't have it handy. Because I think I packed it to be able to think of the word coupling.
Okay, finish your question.
Well, I was going to take it to read tomorrow, you know, and I didn't get to it today.
I understand. The word coupling is a translation of the word zivug, because he didn't want to say sexual intercourse.
Right, I'll figure that
out. Why he didn't want to say sexual intercourse, I don't, you know, I understand the hesitancy, but it's, you know, I disagree with it. That's why I said it. But that's what Zvug is translated in, you know, as coming together in a sexual union. When a married couple is having intercourse that is after the time that a child can be drawn because she's been through menopause, that coupling, that sexual intercourse, creates the souls of converts. So yes, it is on a level of, it's not taking place in the physical world. The action is taking place in the physical world, but at the same time, the action is taking place in the spiritual world. And that's where the souls of converts are created.
Is that in Atsilut?
I'm sorry?
Is that happening in Atsilut?
No, it happens in Yetzirah, it happens in Bria, and it happens in Atzilut. When you do an action, if you hammer a nail, as an example, or you are baking a cake, that same action is taking place in all of the three upper worlds. Exactly at the same moment. It's being done by that part of your soul that represented in living in those three different levels. When you eat a piece of cake or a piece of pie or a sandwich, you look at the sandwich, you look at the cake, and you see the cake. But what you don't see is the three upper levels that are in the three upper worlds. And so when you eat the cake, the people in the other three levels, you in the other three levels are eating the cake as well. Now, it's not the same idea because we need physical food. They don't need physical food, but they're receiving the sustenance associated with that physical food that is relative to their world. You look outside your window and you see grass. Well, there's grass in the world of Yetzirah. There's grass in the world of Bria. There's grass in the world of Atzilut. Is it grass as we know it, green colored blades and so forth? You have to go and visit those worlds and see what grass appears. The grass in certain worlds, they speak. Their consciousness is being expressed to two people. So when people would step on grass in the physical world, as we sometimes do, but we're cautioned on Shabbat, don't step on grass. Why? Because the world has elevated, the physical world has elevated, and the grass is more unified. And so when you step on it, in the upper world, the pain of that being stepped on is being expressed to your higher soul. We don't understand what goes on. But getting back to your question, I'm sorry I got sidetracked. In the various worlds, when you got married, you may or may not, let's assume it's not your cosmic soulmate, but in the world of Atzilut, the only zivug that takes place is between cosmic soulmates. So it depends on what level the individual marriage is.
Well, I took it to mean that it was after death. you know, and the souls were...
No, no, it's not after death.
It's
every
not after
Friday.
Death.
It's
okay.
Shabbat.
Okay, all right.
It is also after death because the soulmates are together every Shabbat in the Garden of Eden. And that's the only time the Zivug takes place in the Garden of Eden is on Shabbat.
But that answers my question.
I believe it's in the Parasha of Pikudei. There's a description of how the women are separated by a wall or machitza from the men in the Garden of Eden. But during the night of Shabbat, after midnight, is when they come together in Zivug.
What do you mean they come together?
Zivug means sexual union. It actually means communication. So, but it's a sexual or it can be verbal. Zivug means unification of consciousness.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. So consciousness comes together. And they enjoy,
yes,
they enjoy the energy together.
Correct.
They don't have sexual intercourse like we do physically in this world, in the physical world. They come together as in...
No.
They
come together as... What is a soul? It's a consciousness. When the consciousness comes together, there's a unification and a sharing of energy, a sharing of consciousness, and it creates a soul called a soul of convert. And those souls of converts, they could be the future souls of human beings, or it could be that it's the soul that the ruach of a person comes and puts on as a garment when it comes into the world.
So I'm going to ask this question. So when a man and a woman come together and has sexual intercourse, they have orgasms at the same time, hopefully. So with the souls in the Garden of Eden, they also have the same feeling as we do here physically, yeah, as in orgasm in which it creates the soul.
The purpose of an orgasm is to share pleasure.
Right.
So they come together and have orgasms in that world, but it's not the same. There's no body to respond in that way.
But they have the feeling.
They receive the pleasure of the life. They have the feeling. They have the consciousness. They have the sharing of consciousness, which can be even more enhanced and much more pleasurable than the physical pleasures.
Right. So when they come together on Shabbat, when is the soul created? When they do unite as one?
Yes, it's created out of the energy of that's shared.
Okay.
That's a guess, because we didn't read that per se.
Right.
But our purpose as human beings is to be co-creators.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what is the highest form of creation in our world? It's the bringing of a child. So it stands to reason that the sharing of energy between a man and a woman in this world that brings a child also brings that soul of the convert.
Mm-hmm. Well, it made me wonder if it would cause your future generations to convert. You know, that might play in with your own family.
It may very well.
Yeah, we've not read it.
We haven't read it. We haven't been taught it. We haven't heard it from a sage. So we need to be very careful in how we explain that.
Right. But we ask the question, and somewhere soon or somewhere along the way, the answer will come to our question. We just can't.
That is correct.
Say. Right. Okay. So we ask the question and we expect an answer somewhere along the way. Okay. All right.
But you can ask the question like you are to me as a teacher, or you can ask the question to yourself as a dream question.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, I didn't think of the question until we brought it out in this discussion.
Of course. But the answer to this question wants to be revealed. And so it motivated you to ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
Which question are we asking? We've asked several. So which one are we talking about right now? What?
Malka, don't confuse me with details.
I want to make sure that I have the dream question that we're asking. There are several questions about the Garden of Eden and the souls coming together. So which one are we on? Which question?
But the last question that I think I was answering was, does the soul of converts become a new human soul, or is it the garment that the Ruach takes on in order to come into this world when it didn't complete itself in the first incarnation?
That's a very good question. All right.
And see, I was then asking, I wondered if it didn't fall into our own families. I mean, most of us, our children aren't Jewish. We were converts. And converts, you know, at the age of 50. You know, and all born into other religions, you know, into Catholicism here in Louisiana. You know, so it made the coupling then created a question for me was, okay, could that coupling come together and have an effect on either your later descendants, your grandchildren, their grandchildren? You know, could that soul that was created, the soul of a convert, come down into your own family? That was the last question, and we said we would have to wait.
Yeah.
For an answer.
I think that's a very true statement, because not all family members do convert, but it may take years. It may take several generations before that soul of that convert comes down into one of the family members.
Look, when I was called, when I got the call to teach Torah, you know, it was to teach my people the difference between the holy and the profane. But it was, and I had been a teacher all my life, but it took 15 years for that to come about. So long so that I began to think, oh, I didn't hear this. But then about a month before I was asked to teach, I read where it said that when the students are ready, the teacher will come. And that's when I saw, hey, it wasn't me. It was the students weren't ready.
So that's why it took 15
years, you know. So generations, what does it matter if you know that it's generations to come, if that's the truth? I mean, what a blessing, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and and I hear this all the time, you say 50, you know, when I was 50, I hear a lot of women say that they were in their 50s when their life started to turn around. Is that 50? I mean, there's 50 gates to Venus, which is the female aspect. I don't know if there's association with that age where women's lives are, you know, not all, but every time I hear someone say, oh, my life changed when I was 50, I mean, mine changed when I was in my 50, 53, 54, you know?
Without getting into personal aspects, when a woman completes the menopause, that's when her life changes. Mm-hmm. From that aspect.
And that's exactly.
But it also changes on many different levels. As I said, without getting into personal, you know, there are some women who go into menopause in their early 40s. There are other women that go into menopause. You know, I think I had an aunt who was still having her period in her late 50s. So it's all always relative. Always discuss relativity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for a person, an individual, you know, if you look at the energy of that age, the energy of 54, the energy of 55, if you look at what the Hebrew words are from the Torah, and that's one of the things I'm trying to get the funds together to generate, is so that people can say, what are all the Hebrew words that have a gematria of 55? Or 54, 53, and you will see how those words will tell you what happens to you in that year of your life. But it's always relative to the soul.
That even goes to the Levites. You know, the Levites and the temple have to retire at 50, right? So,
yes, they had to retire at 50 for the reason that on a physical level their voice could no longer be as beautiful, because the muscle of the voice, the voice box, which is essentially a vibrating string or series of strings, they couldn't vibrate to the same level. They lost quality of voice. It still happens.
Well, I thought it was a blessing with converting at the age that I did after menopause, because there isn't a mikveh anywhere around. And so it was, I mean, I had to go through the mikveh for conversion, but had I still had cycles, it would have been very hard with no myth all around, you know. So, in a way, I saw the age as a blessing. You know, you always think, oh, why did I have to be so old before? You know, why'd I have to be 50-something? Why couldn't I have, you know, come to this knowledge at a much earlier age? But when I tried to find you know, the positive side of the age, that was one of the blessings.
And knowing you, Hannah, if you had still been in your cycle when you converted, you would have organized the building of the mikveh.
Well, I tried to figure out how to do that.
That's true.
We had a storeroom on that particular house, and when the rabbi came, we were trying to figure out how we could make a mikveh in Lake Charles. So, yes, you're right. Either that or I would cry every month, you know, and I couldn't get to the mikveh.
I can see that probably is a blessing. He just, you know, still knows. Wow.
You all have a beautiful evening.
Okay.
Too. Thanks, Mano.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
Shalom to all.